Now is the time, episode 19. I'm Caleb Succo, and this is the podcast where we talk about how we can use our lives right now to worship our God. Friends, I am glad to be back in America after a quick trip to Ukraine. I was there for just about a week, and boy, I did not expect Ukraine to be going through a revolution when I planned this quick trip. Just about, like I said, about 6 days I was in Ukraine, and the reason that I went was because of some pretty important meetings that had already been planned in advance that I needed to attend with our group of missionaries that serve in Ukraine. I'll tell you a little bit more about those meetings later. But what I want to talk about in this podcast is really just about what is going on in Ukraine right now, especially in Kyiv, because I think most of you have probably seen on the news the clashes between riot police and protesters. And, well, frankly, things are heating up, especially there in the capital of Kyiv, which I was there Monday. This Monday I was there in Kyiv. And let me just start off. I want to just kind of describe for you the situation. Describe for you basically what I saw on Monday, because I was in Ukraine for a week, and I spent most of that week in Odessa, which is where we live and serve, and that is south of Kyiv on the Black Sea. That's where we live, and it's about, well, it's an overnight train ride. So usually, if we travel by train, it's about 9 hours to the south of Kyiv. You can drive it in the car in about 5.5-6 hours. So I think it's about 300 miles or so. And I flew into Odessa, but because of the way, well, just actually to get a cheaper ticket, I ended up flying out of Kyiv. And then I was, well, in a way I was glad that I did, because I wanted to see what was going on there, but maybe a little bit worried too, because I didn't want the upheaval and uprising in Kyiv to shut down the airport, which actually I heard that today they did shut down the airport for a while, but I was able to get out of there before they did. I arrived back in the U.S. yesterday, which was, well, Tuesday for me. So what did I see there? So I spent the first several days in Odessa, and then I went up on Sunday night, which Sunday, that was Sunday the, I'm still kind of coming to as far as jet lag and everything, so trying to get my dates straight and everything like that. But let's see, Sunday was the 8th, I believe, is that right? The 8th, and Sunday they had a large rally with, they were estimating somewhere between 500,000 and up to maybe 1 million people that gathered in Maidan Square, which they're calling Euro Maidan now, and they had a very large rally there Sunday night. Well, I got there Monday morning, rolled in on the train just a little after 8 o'clock, and then I put my luggage in storage, and of course it started snowing Sunday night, so by the time I got there Sunday morning, there was a good blanket of snow, and the wind was blowing a little bit. It was kind of cold and pretty snowy, and so then I hopped on the subway to downtown Kyiv, where I met my brother-in-law, Mike Gustafson. And, you know, we popped up on the subway near the center there. I had to walk a little ways. And when we got to the center, so the Maidan Square, the street there is called Kryshchatyk, and that is pretty much where most of these confrontations between the riot police and almost anything that you've seen on the news has been right in that area, Kryshchatyk, or what they call Maidan Nezalezhnosti, which means Freedom Square. And now they're calling it Euromaidan, just naming it sort of after what this whole, or what started this whole situation, which is the president of Ukraine not signing an agreement with the European Union, because the European Union offered to help Ukraine financially. And instead of turning to the European Union, he has, it seems, turned towards Russia and Putin. And of course, people are not too happy about that. But let me just say something on that note. A lot of people have asked, and I've seen people discussing it, you know, what's the big deal, European Union or Russia or Putin? And honestly, my feeling that I got from being in Ukraine and talking with a number of people is that it's not purely just about, yes, we want to be part of the European Union, or we don't want to be united with Russia and Putin. It's not purely about that. I think that for many of the Ukrainian people, it is a general discontentment with the current government and what they would probably view as just Tymoshenko has been in prison for a couple of years now, and a number of things that they see the president has done that people view as not in the best interest of the people, but just done because it promotes the president himself personally, or those that he has in power around him, or Putin, because a lot of people would say that the president of Ukraine is under Putin's control. And so there's a lot of things that have added up to this final, maybe you could say, straw that broke the camel's back when the president did not sign an agreement with the European Union and agree to their help. And so really you can think of it as a larger issue, not just about Europe versus Russia, although that might represent a lot of what is happening there. So anyway, we took the subway in and to downtown. And when we got there, it was just about 9 o'clock in the morning. So obviously there were not 500,000 people there. There were a few thousand people. They have a large stage set up right in the center of the square down there. And they already, you know, they had a singer up there. I can't remember who it was, singing songs and just talking to the people and encouraging them, telling them not to give up. And of course, that was a centerpiece to what was going on there. And then off to the side a little bit, they had a number of large, very large pots where they had people had donated or what, but where they cooked soup and hot food for the people. Because, you know, there are tents set up in that square where people are just kind of camping out. And so they want to try to feed them. And so people were preparing these I can't think of the word in English. But these giant pots of soup. And they had probably about three of them, and open fires. And that was kind of a weird thing, because it was one of the first things that I noticed that when we got to the square, you know, it smells like like you're out in the woods camping. You don't, because of all of the wood smoke, because people have barrels and they're burning wood smoke. And even when we went in the malls, they have a mall like under the ground there, and it just smells like wood fire. So that was kind of unusual. But of course, one of the probably center points of this whole thing is Kyiv usually sets up this huge Christmas tree right in the middle of Maidan, the square there. And they were, I think that they were just getting ready to set that up. At least they had put up the structure. And I'm not sure how tall that tree is, but my guess is going to be about 80 feet tall or so. It's really huge. And the city did not complete setting it up. They set up the structure, the metal structure for it. And instead of putting they cover it with some sort of a fake branches and lights and things like that. So instead of doing that, the protesters have covered it with flags, Ukrainian flags, and different slogans written on them, different posters, and the largest of all of those posters is one with the face of Yulia Tymoshenko. So she has become sort of central as a figure that obviously she would be for cooperation with the European Union and for receiving their help. But she's in prison, and she was put there by the current president of Ukraine. So that is one of the centerpieces. And then the other thing that you notice there, of course, a lot of Ukrainian flags, people are holding Ukrainian flags, but a lot of people draped in Ukrainian flags. So people kind of put them around their neck, draped them over their shoulders, and walking around like that. And it was interesting, too. There would be groups of people walking around, and they would shout out slogans. Like, they would say, "Praise Ukraine, praise the heroes," and people would answer, "Praise Ukraine, praise the heroes." And there was just, it was an interesting sense of sort of a hope that these people had, that they felt like they could make some sort of real change in the country. Like they were doing something that would affect that change, that would matter in the future. But of course, it was also kind of a sort of a tense hope, because right around the corner, those riot police were sitting there waiting for their orders to go and clear things out if they needed to be. And the other thing that you notice, of course, is the barriers that these protesters had set up. And so there are about three or four main streets that come into the square, and the square is kind of low, and so these streets come down into the square, and the protesters had set up barriers, large barriers, on each of these main roads that come down into the square, so that if and when the riot police come in to break things up, that those barriers would stop them. And so these barriers were made out of wood, crates, pieces of metal, dumpsters. I mean, it was anything that they could find. They piled it on. And in fact, I think they used some of the material from that Christmas tree, that large Christmas tree there in the center, for some of those barriers. And they're hoping, that would keep the riot police out. Now, if you have watched any of the news coverage since or from yesterday, you probably saw the riot police moving in. They moved in last night about 3 o'clock in the morning, or I should say this morning, 3 o'clock in the morning. And it did slow them down a lot, because they had to cut and pull and break and try to remove those barriers. But of course, you could walk around the barriers, but it just was mainly barricading the road so that wouldn't be so easy for a large force, or you could not drive down those roads. So we walked up out of Maidan Square there, or Euromaidan, like they're calling it now, or Maidan Nezalezhnosti, which means Freedom Square. So we walked up out of there, and then we walked up this, trying to think, the name of that street, I think, is called Institutska Street. And we walked up and past the presidential palace. And of course, there was a large number of riot police standing. And once you get up there, you have barriers that the police have put up to keep the protesters out. So on one hand, you have barriers that the protesters have put up to keep the police out. And then you have barriers that the police have put up to keep the protesters out. And actually, the police just used buses, and they just parked them between the buildings on the streets, so that they just went completely from one building to another and parked them too thick, two rows of buses that were just perpendicular to the road there. And then behind them, you can see the riot police guarding the governmental building and the presidential palace. And actually, as we walked around up there, they have kind of entrances to the yards, where you have a big apartment building and you can drive under the building. They have a kind of arched entryway, and you'd see a bus parked there with riot police in the bus and riot police standing in front of the bus guarding it. So there were quite a few. And then there was another area where it was a protester made on a different street. I can't think what that street was. Protesters had made another large barrier, and right across on the other side of the barrier was the riot police. So it was a very tense situation as well, and just not knowing when those riot police might act. And then the final thing that we went and looked at was, if you watched, I'm pretty sure it was Sunday night. No, actually, I take that back. Saturday night, they pulled down the Lenin statue, a fairly good-sized Lenin statue. And so we went there, and that was just about two blocks up from Maidan Square. And that there's Lenin laying on the ground, large group of people around, and one guy with a hammer, a little hammer, actually. I was kind of surprised. I thought I would see some sledgehammers out there and stuff. He had a little hammer, banging away on a piece of this Lenin statue and breaking off little chips and giving it out to people as sort of, souvenirs. And so that was kind of an exciting place. But as we were there and getting ready to leave, we saw more trucks and buses pulling in with riot police. And, well, I take that back. That wasn't the last place. The last place that then we walked by was the city building, where protesters had actually gone in and taken over the city building, and they were living inside. And I believe that even today, as I'm recording this, they are still in control of that building. I'd have to check that out, but I think that they might be. And I noticed that yesterday they were spraying down the front steps with water, so it would be slippery if the riot police came in, and doing all that they could to keep, and actually trying to get armor for the guys that were staying in there, and sticks and things. So kind of crazy stuff, when you talk about revolution. And now I want to make a couple of comments here, because one of the things that I noticed is that there is a similarity between what happens when there is a revolution and what happens when there is revival. So I'm using those two words, revolution and revival, as revolution, to talk about political change, what's going on in Ukraine right now, those types of things, where not just political change, but radical political change that is brought on by protesters and the people rising up and challenging the government. And revival, When I say revival, I'm talking about spiritual change. And spiritual change, not just in one individual, but when it happens on a broad scale in a country or a city or an area. And what I notice is that, first of all, both revolution and revival are preceded by brokenness. And that is certainly true. I mean, in Ukraine, as far as the revolution goes, if people didn't feel some sort of sense of brokenness or some sort of sense that this is not right, that things aren't working the way they should work, then there would be no revival or no revolution. If they felt like everything was working fine, there were no problems, then, why would there be any need for a revolution? So, and the same thing is true with revival. Spiritually, revival only comes after people have felt their need, their brokenness very deeply in their souls. And so both revolution, revival, are preceded by brokenness and characterized by a general sense that there needs to be change, that there's something that needs to be fixed, that something is wrong, something is not working, and it needs to be changed. And so both really revolution and revival, they also, they have sort of a spirit, a new spirit of hope that they bring with them. And I would have to say that was one thing that I noticed about just walking around is that there was this sort of hopeful spirit in the air among the protesters that something was going to change, something new was going to happen, and it was going to be good, and it was going to be helpful. There's this hope for the future. And of course, when we talk about revival, of course, we're talking about a spiritual hope. We're talking about eternal hope, hope that is much longer lasting than any government can give us, right? But also that there is that sense of a spirit of hope in both revolution and revival. And then finally, one of the characteristics of both revolution and revival is that people are willing to sacrifice. And they're willing to sacrifice because they understand that there is a greater good than just being comfortable themselves, than just making themselves comfortable or just getting something that they personally want. And it's interesting to see in revolution that, people are willing to sacrifice themselves physically and risk being harmed, risk being put in jail. Why? Because they believe that if they accomplish their goal, that it will ultimately serve the good of many thousands or millions of people. And the same thing is true for revival, but of course in a much greater way. People are willing to sacrifice. They're willing to sacrifice their time, their finances, and oftentimes risk, take personal, financial, and physical risks for the gospel because they believe, and it's true, that risk is worth it because the good is so much greater than just they themselves. And the good is so much greater than just this temporary life. And so, because of that, they are willing to sacrifice, even if it is not for because it's not for personal gain, but for gain of the greater good. And when you talk about the gospel, it is for eternal gain. And so, let me answer two questions here. And one is somebody had asked me recently, in fact, I believe it was Carl on Twitter, and I'll put a link to Carl's Twitter profile on the show notes for this show. But the question is, should Christians participate in protests? And that's a valid question. That is one that we probably should think about and have an answer in our minds. Because what is going on in Ukraine right now, you know, it's not so far off from something that could happen in America or in any other country in the world. So should Christians participate in protests like these? And, you know, I come back to a couple of key ideas here when I consider this for myself. And the first is that, you know, as you look at Scripture, it's quite clear that we are called to pursue and promote holiness, righteousness, biblical standards. And so that's why Jesus said, be holy, because your Father's holy, right? And that is why the prophets also, when they address the leaders of Israel, and not just the leaders of Israel, but they address leaders of a lot of different countries. But when they addressed them, they didn't just point out political decisions, but they focused on morality. They focused on morality. And so I think that when we evaluate as Christians whether or not we should take part or join some sort of protest, we need to think about the biblical ramifications, and we need to think about what is it really that is that protest is saying. And if it is clearly speaking against a sinful behavior or an endorsement of some sort of action that is clearly wrong, then, you know, I think it's okay. I think it's okay. But we need to make sure that it's not just protesting some sort of a political decision that we sort of don't like, you know, oh, higher taxes or, you know, labeling of food or something. I think it was one recently here in Washington where it's not particularly a moral decision that is clearly spelled out in Scripture. And in those cases, I think that we ought to probably hold back if it's not particularly a moral issue. But when it comes to moral issues, I think not only are we allowed to protest, but we have a right, we have a responsibility as followers of Christ to speak up and point out those sinful behaviors. And so we have a right. Now, that doesn't always, or we have a responsibility. That doesn't always mean that we will do it in protest fashion, but we need to be clear about what God thinks about it and what the Bible says about it. And of course, you know, if we are participating in some sort of protest, I think that we ought to do, you know, as much as possible to stay within the boundaries of the law. And the only exception to that would be if the government asks us to do something that is clearly not biblical, or tells us that we shouldn't do something that clearly, if we don't do it, it would violate biblical morals. Like when the city government told Peter, you can't preach the gospel. And he said, well, you judge for yourself. Who should we obey, God or man? So that would be the only exception to that rule. So yeah, I think Christians can participate in protests, but we need to be careful that those protests are clearly about moral issues and not just about our preference in politics. And, you know, there's a couple other things that I think when we talk about what we need to keep in mind as Christians. And I think these are vital. And it would help us to make the decision too. Is this a type of protest that I want to participate in, that I should participate in or not? And the first is, you know, even political unrest, like we see in Ukraine right now, which we think is terrible, and it is, but even those situations God can use for his glory. And they are often an opportunity for the gospel. And that's why I talked about the similarities between revolution and revival. Because oftentimes revolution creates a situation where revival can take place. So political unrest can really be an opportunity for the gospel, and it's an opportunity that we need to take advantage of. Secondly, you know, we need to make sure that we are praying. And I would ask you to pray for Ukraine at this time. And pray, you know, pray for heart change. That's really what's going to solve the problem. So pray for heart change among the leaders. Pray for heart change amongst Ukrainians, that they would turn to God, because that's what they ultimately need. And third thing that we need to realize and we need to keep in mind is this. Friends, governments come and go, but Jesus is forever. Let me just say that again, because I think this is powerful, and I think it changes our attitude and the way that we view some of these revolutions and political unrest. Governments come and go, but Jesus is forever. And then finally, the organization that will make the biggest and longest lasting difference is, what do you think? It's the church. The organization that will make the biggest and longest lasting difference is the church. And so if we want to make a difference, we need to invest in the church. And that brings me back to something I briefly mentioned at the beginning. I originally went to Ukraine to be a part of meetings for our team of missionaries in Ukraine. And during those meetings, we decided our purpose for being in Ukraine. And our purpose for being in Ukraine, you know, simply stated, is this: to partner with Ukrainians and help them plant and strengthen churches in Ukraine and beyond. And that is why I am so excited and encouraged to be able to minister in Ukraine and focus on strengthening the church, because it is the only organization that will have an eternal, long-lasting difference in Ukraine. Now, I understand there are other ministries and things that will have maybe also eternal ramifications, but you know, it's the church that really God has set up to be the instrument that brings the gospel into a world of unrest, into a world where politicians may not tell the truth, where people suffer financially and physically, where there is oppression. It is the church that God has specifically ordained and set up to take on those problems, to bring God's word to light on those problems, and then to change cities and countries and nations from the inside out. And folks, I want to ask that you would join me, especially now, this week, this month, and pray for Ukraine. And don't just pray for the leaders, but we need to pray for them, but pray also for the churches. Pray that churches would take the opportunity, take advantage of this time to reach people's hearts with the gospel of Jesus Christ. All right, friends, if you want to check out some of the photos I took on Monday as I walked around Kyiv, Ukraine, as well as some links to video, just go to sukofamily.org/19. That'll take you right to the show notes for this episode. And also, if you have a chance, I'd appreciate if you could subscribe on iTunes and leave a rating and a review, because that will help this podcast get out to more people. So appreciate that. And also, if you don't use iTunes, you can check it out on Stitcher. And both those links are on the show notes for this episode, episode 19. All right, friends, blessings.